All right, it's 1:30. We're going to go ahead and get started with our next session, which is the Joe Witte Station Scientist Symposium. And we've got chairs Vanessa Alonso and TJ Springer.
Hello, everyone from sunny Southern California, where dew points, by the way, are in the 50s. First, I'd like to thank you for the honor you have bestowed on me. I am humbled and honored by your gesture. But I salute all of those who have served on the Station Science Committee all these many years, and all of you who have shared science with your viewers, whether on air or during your visits to schools or civic groups or at museums or aquariums. Today, with severe weather, climate change, and pandemics, science communication is more important than ever. Your viewers are naturally curious about how things work and new discoveries. Whether you sneak it in as a quick 20-second VO, or a 1 or 2 minute explainer on air, or in classrooms, viewers will be able to say, aha, now I get it. That's cool. If we don't do it, if we don't do science, who will? You are the scientist in the newsroom. You are the person the audience trusts. In today's wild west of social media, trust is more critical than ever. Together, through education and citizen actions, we can sustain our fragile blue planet. Again, thank you so much for saluting me in such a meaningful way. I was, am, and always inspired by you, the AMS broadcast community. I remember the 1975 meeting in San Diego, 50 years ago. Science communication is really education. So in closing, I'll quote John Wooden, the great basketball coach. In the end, it's about teaching. And teaching contributes more to the future of our society than any other single profession. Once again, thanks so much, and have a very productive conference.
Joe really wanted to be here, so that was his little tribute to try and send us all well wishes, and he couldn't have been happier to know that this symposium is now named after him. I know he's been a pioneer. He's done so much for not just the meteorology community, but the STEM field as a whole, so he was just over the moon, so he really wished he could have been here in person. But I'm TJ Springer. I am the Station Scientist Committee Chair this year, and I'm a meteorologist at WGAL Television in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Do I really need an introduction?
Yeah, girl, do it.
Hello, you wonderful, happy people. For those of you who don't know who have been hiding under a rock and don't know who I am Vanessa Alonso. I am the broadcast board, CDM board, and I am going to be the Station Scientist Committee chair next year, so my AMS involvement is not done yet. So let's go ahead and kick it off with two amazing people, the one and only Dave Jones and Ellen Prager with the future with It's time to step up your game. Your audience needs you.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you so much. Oh, it was so hard to get Dave to come up here with me.
Stop, I'm so nervous.
So for those of you who heard last year at the meeting, we were asking questions of all of you. What are some of the frequently asked questions you get, some of the zany questions you get? And from those, we said we're going to write a book. Well, in fact, we have, and it's going to come out this October. And so we thought today we're going to show you some of the content, kind of a teaser, some of the content, some of the things we've covered, because we really hope our purpose with this was that for you and for other communicators of science who might be asked to cover things outside of your field, it would be a great resource. So, for instance, let's see. Now, you are called the station scientist, but we all know you're asked to cover things more than just the weather. Things like climate change, sharks, harmful algal blooms, jellyfish. But it's not just the questions that people ask. You also...
What are these? We also have some cartoons in there, some drawings. And let's see, mind control, chemtrails, oh brother, condensation and cirrus clouds. So you also have to combat misinformation that you hear, and we're seeing that every day.
When we started writing the book, of course, there was a lot of discussion about how many chapters on the ocean and how many on the atmosphere we should have.
Yeah, first of all, that's me sweating. And I don't know why I'm sweating while we're arm wrestling.
What happened to your holiday?
That is my mustache. It's not my teeth.
Oh.
So it's... okay. It's not...
We had some interesting discussions with the artist. So the first chapter in the book is about the deep sea. And if you are an ocean scientist, or if you're talking about the ocean, I guarantee one of the first questions you're going to get is, are there megalodons still in the ocean? What about mermaids? Thank you to the Discovery Channel for the mockumentary mermaid films, megalodons. We like to call them, docu-make-believes. People really think that they're real. And we don't have anything against mermaids or megalodons. We love mermaids. It's just that they're not real. There's no data. There's no bones. There's no fossils. And megalodons. Okay, let's just think about this. If megalodons were still swimming around the ocean, sharks in their lifetime shed about 40,000 teeth. And megalodons were known to swim in tropical, subtropical waters, probably near the coast because that's where the most food was. So we would have found some teeth. Nada. None. No evidence.
Zilch.
Zilch. None. Megalodons are not swimming around in the ocean today.
That last picture I took of Ellen there is a little suspect. Well, go ahead.
I was going to say, but it is funny when you're talking to middle graders and you have this really precocious young man says to you, well, you just said 10%, only 10%, if less, of the ocean has been explored. How do you know they're not down there?
Smart ass.
Dave is great with the kids. They just love him. We also have a chapter on dangerous marine life because lots of people want to know. Of course, the number one thing is sharks. So we cover things like what are the chances of being bitten? Can they see color? People always talk about yum, yum, yellow, what not to wear. It turns out they're colorblind. They can't see color, but they can see contrast. So they might be able to see yellow because of the contrast of the background. Can they smell blood a mile away? Pretty famous question. Turns out the answer is no. The research suggests that maybe they can detect blood within a body of water about the size of a small swimming pool. And one of my favorites, do nurse sharks bite? Nurse sharks are one of the few sharks that can lie on the bottom and pump water on the gills. So people think, oh, I'm going to pull their tail. Let me pet one. Or there is a story of somebody decided to pucker up. Nurse sharks bite. Don't do any of those. Jellyfish. Jellyfish, those of you who are along the coast have to deal with this. And the most common questions. And it's
how many of you have heard this question?
Yes, see, hands, yeah. That's right. Should you pee or your friend pee on a jellyfish sting? The easy answer to that is
no.
But there's actually science behind that. It turns out what triggers the sting is either contact or change in chemistry. Your urine does not have the same pH as seawater. So in fact, if you or your friend were to pee on a jellyfish sting, it would probably make it worse. So no is the answer.
Well, and before we go any further, I just have to say something. We had a sketch artist that we worked with, and you know, I was a bit perturbed because she didn't give me enough hair. And so I asked her for more hair, and this is what she did. She gave me a ponytail. That's it. So
for those of you who are, especially if your market is along the coast and jellyfish comes up, what should you do? Rinse it with vinegar. That's the first thing. And in fact, we were talking about, does that mean you have to go to the beach with vinegar? A lot of the lifeguards now at their stands have vinegar. So first thing is rinse with vinegar, get the cells, the stinging cells off your skin, and then it turns out heat will deactivate the venom. So vinegar, get the stuff off your skin, and then deactivate with heat. Coral reefs. So this is a topic very close to my heart. When I was doing research, I worked in coral reefs. And, of course, all of you know, I'm sure, that we're seeing mass mortalities around the world due to climate change. And I don't really have time to go into the details about why corals bleach when you have prolonged seawater high seawater temperatures. But please, if you want to get a more detailed explanation, stop me. I'm always happy to talk about coral reefs over the next rest of today or tomorrow. I'll be here. But it's going to continue to be in the news, and it's really important to get it right as to why this is happening. And you also are going to be hearing about a lot of things about coral restoration, things that can be done to stop corals from dying. Well, there's a problem with that. If the conditions in the ocean are what killed the corals to begin with, and you put more corals down there, those corals are going to die as well. And unfortunately, we saw that in 2023, where corals that were grown in undersea nurseries all died because of high seawater temperatures. And things like underwater music played to the corals. Those aren't going to work either. We have to fix the underlying problem. Dave,
so,
back to you.
My turn. So we got a lot of weather forecasting questions, but one of the things that we're doing in the book, you know, do they really understand the forecast? How many of you have heard this quote before? I'd love to be right only 50% of the time and still get paid, right? Exactly. A lot of us have heard that. So we talk about weather forecasting and how accurate it is, and do people really understand the forecast? A lot of these discussions happen here at this conference last year and previous conferences, and also long-term forecasts. Are they accurate? You know, can't wait to see the 30-day forecast as they enter fantasy land. We also talk about hurricanes. We have a chapter on hurricanes. Questions, why don't they tow an iceberg into the Gulf of Mexico and cool it down? How about we create an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico to stop all the heat from rising and evaporation? Why don't we just nuke them, right? Right. And the cone of uncertainty is its own predicament that we've been hearing over the last couple of years. So we talk about that too. And then, is Kim in this room? Where is Kim Cloco McLean? She's probably in the other. So I think she has this problem in the Midwest as well. The old Indian mound theory, where we're protected from hurricanes because we live near an Indian mound.
Oh, you see how it's going.
It's going to protect us. Well, we put together a little graphic of all the blue points which are Indian mounds, and also the hurricane tracks going back to the 1840s. Brian, we're going to adjust that track for the one going into Miami. So, and 800 prehistoric burial mounds. Approximately 484 sites are within less than 1 mile of a storm track. Look at that. No protection.
We have a chapter on climate change and some of our favorite questions. Hasn't the climate always changed? There's too little CO2 in the atmosphere to make a difference. What about the sun? Volcanoes? Can't we just adapt? So working with some climate change experts, we made easy to understand, not too long answers to these and other questions that we know we all get. And then how about this one? Wait, in the 1970s, weren't scientists predicting an ice age? And in fact, there's evidence because there was a Time magazine cover about that. Well, in fact, no, that was a fake cover put out in 2013 based on a 2007 Real Time magazine cover. So we're going to debunk some myths in this chapter as well. We also have a chapter on the sun that we actually worked with NASA scientists on, cover sun, sort of misconceptions about the sun, space weather, auroras, one of my favorites, explaining the green flash. Yes, it's real. We have chapters on lightning, sort of suspicious versus supernatural.
What are you looking at me for? You wrote it. Oh, oh sorry. No. You're right.
So For those of you who get asked to cover stories that you're not comfortable with, things that may not be your expertise, first of all, confirm that that story is not misinformation by looking for multiple sources, credible sources. Find the original study data. That's what we do all the time. People ask us questions about stories, and we go out and look for the data. And then also contact an expert. And for those of you who are sort of new to the field, find a group of experts that you can cultivate a relationship with. And I'll be happy to say there are a few meteorologists here in the audience that I feel like I've been able to do that. And when there's a question about the ocean or earthquakes or volcanoes, which I have also written about, they call me, either go on air or just answer questions. I don't feel like I always have to go on air, but I'm always happy to answer questions. So the book comes out in October. You can pre-order online now with Amazon or bookstores. And then with some of you have, there's a card on your chairs that goes directly to Columbia University Press. You can pre-order there in July. I also want to recognize the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, as well as NASA, who gave us support for writing the book, which was wonderful. And then before we go to questions.
So we have a QR code for you guys, and I'd like you to scan it because there's two things going on here. We have the book that we just talked about coming up. And for those of you, how many of you have heard of the Glenn Gerberg Weather and Climate Summit that we used to put on at Steamboat and also at Breckenridge last 8 years or so? So we're working on rebooting the Weather and Climate Summit called the Extreme Weather, Climate, and Resilience Summit, Community Resilience Summit. And there's some questions in this QR code we'd love you to fill out. What kind of topics would you like to see? These are going to be like four-day summits. We're hoping to launch the first one in 2025 in Asheville, North Carolina. So that'll be awesome. In Asheville, surprise, surprise, you're going to provide some funding. And and so we'd love for that. We bring experts together with broadcast Mets. We're going to be streaming it live. We're going to be providing live opportunities for you to go back to your stations and all that stuff. And then the goal is to move it around the country as we get further support. So thanks for filling that out. And just one thing that I forgot to say, Ellen is Storm Center's chief scientist, but she's also my fiance. And So just remember.
He never told me he was going to announce it.
So just remember, the Earth and the ocean are the atmosphere and the ocean are a coupled system.
So,
oh my God.
So one last thing, please. We're going to run out of time for questions. If you have questions, we're not shy, obviously. Ask us questions. And just one last thing I want to say is that when you go to that survey, there's also a place if you would like us. We're trying to raise funds to give books to like Title I schools and travel around and give talks. If you would like us to come to your market and do something with you, maybe a local school, please let us know in that questionnaire. I have written some other books, and I've given books to – we live a somewhat privileged life, at least I can say I did. My parents had books. My schools had books. There are a lot of kids out there that don't have books or schools that don't have books, and if we want – informed citizens who can read and pay attention to alerts and things like they need to be able to read and comprehend reading. And so we really want to be able to help get books out there to kids and to adults or high school students that might not have books or have the chance to read. So thank you.
Ellen's written 21 books. This is from nonfiction to kids adventure series that put real science into it. And she would get grants and go around Florida and give books to Title I schools and other kids. Some of these kids, their first book ever. And, you know, Ellen was saying the kid raises his hand and Ellen says, yes, you have a question. She says, are these ours to keep?
Wow.
And, you know, when she says yes, they just hug the book and they just keep reading it. And then they read it to their parents who may not read. So they're able to educate their parents. So one of the ideas, the last item, one of the ideas for this book is when it comes out, if your station wants to purchase books, for you to give out at school visits, to libraries, to whatever. You can then design your own sticker that goes in the front page of the book. The first book says, from Storm Team 4, from Eyewitness News, your team, or whatever. And then these questions are getting answered by the book. You don't have to confront them on the air if you don't feel comfortable, but then you can get the book out. And we would love to talk to you on your show, in your market, as we go around the country and talk about literacy, improving literacy, and also getting information out about climate change, megalodons, and mermaids. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, I want to bring up a close personal friend, one of my professors, actually, Seppi Yoda, for opportunities for effective collaboration between broadcast meteorologists and emergency managers. Excuse me.
Thank you, TJ, and thank you, Lindley, for invitation to speak here. It is wonderful to see so many of our former students doing amazingly well and current students. So this is my first time at this conference, and I'm thrilled to be here. You play such an important role in our community, in our greater community. So today I just wanted to speak with you a little bit about opportunities for greater collaboration between emergency managers and your specific community. So I'm a meteorologist by training. But I have also been directing our Center for Disaster Research and Education for the past 15 years, and we have emergency management programs that range from undergraduate to graduate to graduate certificates. So we've also been involved with a lot of community-based research and also integrated teams that have done both research and impactful practices over the years within our region. So I just wanted to give you a few ideas and hopefully some basis for discussion. So you all play a really important role as a broadcast meteorologist, and I don't have to repeat all of this, but all of this ties really well with what I'm going to say about how you can further contribute to the emergency management community. There's already a lot of collaboration, and there's a lot of context for further growth that I will touch on in a little bit. So there's the forecasting, there's obviously communicating this really important information with the public. There's the education piece, so we just talked about, and Dave, sorry, a hard act to follow here, but I'll come up with something. Trust me, the talk is not over. So you educate, education plays a very important role, and especially right now with issues of climate impacts really affecting every single community. The community engagement is really important. Obviously, you participate in local events. You're known to your communities. You're trusted sources of information in your communities. And, of course, there is a lot of collaboration across different platforms of media now with various social media and all of other ways of communication. And then the collaboration piece is something that we've sort of come about even in the science community. So for the longest part, we operated in silos, but now, for example, emergency managers are working directly with scientists to even form and translate the way the messaging are done and even decision making. So one of the things that we really need to do is build on existing connections. So I want to see a show of hands of how many of you have participated in an integrated warning team or an integrated weather impact team. So this is great. We should take a picture. So these teams already exist. For example, we have one, but it has been more active in the past. We have had an integrated weather impact team in Pennsylvania, which has actually been an extended team. It didn't just comprise of emergency managers and broadcast meteorologists and, of course, National Weather Service offices. It also expanded to other stakeholders. We included the academic community. We had nonprofit organizations. We had utilities involved. And it was a really important discussion in terms of not just formulating those messages, but also in terms of community engagement. So it went beyond just kind of those connections when there was severe weather happening or high impact weather happening, but it was more in a sense of connecting these folks so they know how to talk to each other and they can understand why it's important to have these connections. So most of these usually function through meetings. We had several meetings. We would invite, you know, we would have anywhere from 50 to 70 folks. We would break up in sessions and talk about these things. But then once the meeting was over, a lot of times those connections were lost. And I know that in some communities, those connections are much stronger, and a lot of it depends on those already existing relationships, and those play a very important role. So here are some suggestions just to build on what we're going to talk next, and that is there should be a strong commitment to offering and attending these. So a lot of times these come about. I know that, for example, for our IWIT, the person at our National Weather Service office, the forecast office in State College, Pennsylvania, was the key person that really initiated this, and he worked very hard to engage everyone. But a lot of times you need those one or two folks that are really committed to this and believe in the quality of this this work. Follow-up communications are also really important. And then, of course, how do we get these multi-sector teams to actually work together? And they need to kind of understand what is their need and how well that working together will actually pay off in the long run. So some things to consider as we move forward is that obviously, we're dealing with not only different communities, but there are also a lot of different elements that we have to think about. We have a transdisciplinary community. We need to have excellent communication skills because we're no longer just talking to people from different backgrounds, but we're also dealing with different cultures and different contexts of information. We have to understand what our stakeholders need. And we really have to get into this public-private partnership, which I'll touch on. Obviously, one of our main sponsors for this conference is ClimaVision, which I'll give an example of how that can come about in this partnership. So one element that plays a really key role and kind of connects everything is education. And I'm an educator, so it is really important to think about this. But I truly believe in both formal and informal education. So you're already educators, right? So I'm not the only educator here in this room. All of you are educators, but just in different contexts. But what's important is when we have folks that come from different backgrounds, whether it's meteorology or emergency management, when they actually blend into these different educational settings, they really understand better what is going on. So I don't want to pick on Lindsay, but Lindsay is in our Master of Science in Emergency Management program. And of course, she's sitting in class, a virtual setting, with those that have a meteorology background or emergency management background or any other type of, some of them are social workers. They are come from different backgrounds. So they are talking to each other. And understanding of what each have to say and what the needs are really important for really understanding then later on how to work with each other. So this is just one example. So there are lots of opportunities, and this is not, I'm not promoting our programs. This is just to give you an idea. There are hundreds of other programs online or in person that give you an opportunity to get a certificate in emergency management, or we have a certificate in, let's say, space weather. I think one of our other speakers will touch on that later as well. But again, these integrated ideas, so not just being educated in one area, but actually understanding what an emergency manager knows and how they use that information and how they use that information to make decisions is really important. So this is kind of I wouldn't say the wave of the future. We have been doing this for a number of years, but it's more and more important now because we do have to learn not only how to understand each other, but how to work with each other collaboratively. And that's really important in this workforce development as we are training students. And we're hoping that this will translate to having folks out there that are aware. And of course, all of you are working in this space, but understanding it, it's really important. So we do have to talk about climate in this context because all of you are dealing with this. And so this also introduces a new space for collaboration between meteorologists and emergency managers. So all of you are probably familiar with the National Climate Assessment Reports. This is the fifth one that came out, and they're lots of tools that are associated with these, and these tools are important because they allow the community to know what are the impacts are, because sometimes the idea of climate change sometimes can be a little bit of a, I don't know if I believe in that or I don't believe in that. But if we talk about it in terms of climate impacts, it seems to make a difference. I've gone to Capitol Hill and talked to different representatives, and it seems that when you talk about the impacts in a community, it has completely a different, it influences people a different way than if you talk to them just in terms of climate change. So this report puts out these really nice graphics that show how each region, what are they more likely to be affected by as we progress with a changing climate. And these are really important to use. But we've also kind of moved beyond that. So a brand new report that FEMA has just released, and we're working with emergency managers in this context right now. So we kind of have moved on from climate preparedness, or in general, emergency and crisis planning and preparedness, to this area of adaptation. So when we talk about adaptation, we're also talking about a very different space from just planning for something that's going to happen in the future. So this report came out in April of 2024. And just to give you a quick definition of what climate adaptation is, this is just really an approach to identify what are the risks and hazards for any particular community as a result of environmental and climate change, and then try to determine when you look at these, when you assess the risks of these, to try to minimize the impacts on a related community. So the key takeaway is that first bullet point, which is multi-agency, multi-sector efforts to raise community awareness and try to adapt and try to implement these adaptation plans. So some of the things that are important where I think broadcast meteorologists fit in really well, because there are spaces where you can collaborate and contribute, are that you have a lot of experience with your community's experiences with recent extreme weather events, the characteristics of the population or your viewing audience, impacts of recent weather events on the community, and community values. These are really important as you try to implement these climate adaptation plans. So these opportunities are to work further with emergency managers as they're trying to develop these interorganizational partnerships. These really don't exist, and this is really where emergency management community wants to be in this space of climate adaptation. So we still have a lot of, you know, important work that is done in terms of real-time decision-making that is really important in those integrated warning teams and so on. And there's a lot of effort in planning and preparedness, but this is really the future. So it's really important. So again, emergency managers can really use your help in terms of getting information and linking these communities. So one last pitch here. I don't know how many of you have ever been to the International Association of Emergency Managers meeting. Anybody here? Okay, maybe just a couple of folks. But that's another opportunity. So there's a lot of interest. So I know National Weather Service, NOAA, has a pretty nice presence now for the last couple of years at the IEM meeting. But they always meet in nice locations, just like here. Coming up in Colorado Springs next November. But it's really important because it is also that idea of if we can be in certain spaces and actually understand what they're talking about, what are their needs, right? Not just something that's being translated and sent to us or somebody calling you saying this is what we need. It kind of creates that that connection a lot better. So, again, there's excellent opportunity for nurturing those relationships. So a quick summary, and then I'll just add with kind of a local story of what we have been doing in addition to obviously lots of things that are happening in the community. But these workshops are really important to bring these communities together. And then, of course, educational opportunities. I can't stress that enough. We've had so many students coming through the program that have gone from the broadcast community to becoming important decision makers in the emergency management community, and still, you know, sort of live in both worlds. And they really played an important role because they really understand both of those disciplines really well and how they connect and the synergies between them. So extending these collaborations and these multi-sector collaborations are really important. So this is my last slide. Staying on time here. So on the upper right, this is Christine Fiera, who's a colleague of TJ in our NBC affiliate. She's the chief meteorologist. And so what you see in the lower left-hand corner is the brand new Climate Vision radar that is on top of our water tower on the campus of Millersville University. And this was truly a collaboration where with Climate Vision, this was the first ever educational partnership to bring in the radar, which of course improves our ability to forecast in that area significantly because the closest radar didn't provide any of the information at the lower levels, which was critical for forecasting. And then, of course, there are now, I believe, two or three different broadcast groups that are have also access to that information. And then on top of that, Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency, actually through one of our former students, is now also working with Climate Vision to bring together access to this information for emergency managers in the region. And of course, our National Weather Service, our State College Office is very much involved. They were so excited when we told them about the radar. They kept sending me emails asking me, is this a true story? Are we really getting a radar? And I said, yes, we're definitely getting a radar. There are lots of opportunities, but I think what's key is understanding what are the needs and also thinking beyond just the real-time forecast and the real-time warning setting. Just wanted to share that with you. Thank you so much. Here's my email.
We can take one or two questions, if anybody has any.
I have one. Oh, and I have one for you, Dave. But you go first. And
I'm sorry. Please leave your message at the No, my first question, or my only question is really, I've been in emergency operations centers where they talk to, I guess, other maybe meteorologists, or they have links to models and other things that they might look at, but they're not qualified to make any decisions on that data. And I'm wondering if you have a program at Millersville where you can help to try to educate those. I mean, I would hate to see emergency managers just looking at the radar and looking at this and that and then trying to make their own, conclusion about what might happen when they really need a meteorologist to talk about the impacts and things like that. And I know that the Weather Service does deploy occasionally into those, but not everywhere. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that to better educate emergency managers.
Right. So I think this is kind of along the lines of creating these integrated programs where, you're not necessarily asking an emergency manager to become a meteorologist, but they have an opportunity to take at least one or two applied courses so they can understand, not to the level of a meteorologist, but to be able to at least understand the terminology. And then also, I think these kind of collaborative networks are really critical to know who you would contact, and it's just not one person, but it's actually a community that works together. And that's kind of the, what we're hoping to create. So it's not just that you know someone and you're going to call and say, what do I do? Or am I making this decision right? But to actually create a setting where you're not looking for who should I contact, or you end up making a decision. And again, this is why then working in these long-term settings may work really well, because you already developed that relationship and then it can be translated into other settings. I don't know if that answers your question, but we are doing these sort of accelerated combined programs where people can do meteorology and emergency management or vice versa and through certificates.
Thanks.
So my question for you was, are there really sharks under Paris?
Questions for Ellen.
I don't know if you've seen the film. It's on Netflix. That's what I was referring to.
I would say no.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? I can't hear. I cannot hear the conference, but I will just go ahead and present my presentation. I'm going to talk about hurricanes and climate change. Let me stop sharing. I'm sorry, I cannot hear. Am I being heard? Okay, you says you can hear me online. The audio is not coming through. Okay, so I'm just going to restart my presentation and just run through it, even though I can't hear what's going on there. So just a moment. Your screen. Okay, sorry for the glitch. I'm going to talk about Atlantic hurricanes and climate change, which is a very nuanced topic, and it's one where a lot of questions come up. And so I'm going to give you a quick primer on the topic based on the science, and I apologize in advance. Sometimes these things are, results are confusing, but that's just really the state of the science. And you can get more detail from this web page that I maintain, which you can get to by just Googling global warming and hurricanes. And I'm going to talk about a couple of things, the past right. Data, what does data
can
show about climate
just
change
one
and
second.
Hurricanes?
I'm so sorry.
Your name right, Thomas. He will be talking about
we've lost the Zoom, so we're just going to have to restart. So I'm so sorry. Hold on, please.
Okay.
Hey, Tom, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes. It is okay. All yours, sir.
All mine? Okay. Thank you very much. Apologies, everybody, for the glitch. I'm Tom Knutson from NOAA's Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab in Princeton, and I'm going to give you a quick primer on Atlantic hurricanes and climate change. This is a very interesting topic where I know a lot of questions come up. It's also rather difficult and nuanced topic in climate change science, and some of the results are a little confusing. It can be confusing to explain, but I apologize for that, but that's basically the state of the science. You can learn more about this at the web page that I'm showing here, the Global Warming and Hurricanes web page, which you can get to just by Googling Global Warming and Hurricanes. That's one that I maintain. In the presentation, this is just a quick primer. I'm going to talk about what the past data show on hurricanes. Have they changed over time? And if so, how? Why have they changed over time? And also future projections based on climate models. Okay, so looking first at the past data, these are a lot of time series we have for the Atlantic Basin going back to the 1880s. We have global mean temperature at the top, tropical Atlantic sea surface temperature, the next one down. Both of them showing this rising trend over time. That's the familiar global warming signal. So it's very clear in observations. Now, let's skip down to the orange curve, U.S. landfalling hurricanes. That one actually has no trend since the late 1800s, in contrast to global mean temperature. That's important to keep in mind. Now, the blue curve, raw hurricane counts for the Atlantic Basin, that's looking at all hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin. That seems to be tracking up over time. So what's going on here, where U.S. landfalling hurricanes are not changing, but basin-wide hurricanes are tracking up along with global mean temperature? We think that one of the things that's going on is that there are missing storms in the raw hurricane count out over the open basin. And when you account for these missing storms in the pre-satellite era, we actually estimate that there's no trend even in the basin-wide count. That's the red. That's the red curve here. So this is an example. No clear evidence at this point for a detectable century-scale trend in Atlantic hurricane activity, at least after you adjust for these changes in observing capabilities. However, we have had sea level rise, and that's really important because when you have higher sea level, the storms are riding in on a higher background sea level. So the inundation from storm surge is going to be greater under the sea level rise scenario than in a pre-industrial climate. So climate change is having an impact on hurricanes because the sea level rise from climate change is adding to these inundation levels. That's important to keep in mind. Now, if we look at major hurricanes, so these are the category 3 or higher hurricanes, and that's just the right-hand column here. We have different examples of major hurricane time series. The upper right is the U.S. landfalling major hurricane count, and that, like hurricanes overall, has interestingly no long-term trend over the past century. Even though the second one down, Atlantic hurricane basin-wide major hurricanes, does have a rising trend. But again, we think that rising trend in basin-wide major hurricanes is again driven mainly by changes in observing capabilities, that our ability to observe these things has gotten so much better in the satellite era from the mid-1960s on. So after adjustment, that's the bottom right curve, the blue curve in the bottom right panel, that's our estimate. Again, we don't think that we see a long-term trend in major hurricanes basin-wide. We do see multi-decadal variability with sort of a quiet period in 1960s and 70s. So U.S. landfalling power dissipation, again, another index of what's hitting the coast. No long-term trend, but there are big fluctuations going on, and maybe the fluctuations are getting bigger, but there's no long-term trend, at least at this point. Rapid intensification. Okay, so this is an important aspect of tropical cyclones, and we think it has been increasing in the Atlantic since 1980. A lot of things have been increasing in the Atlantic since 1980. We think that this change we're seeing, this increase, may be right at the edge of what we would expect from natural variability. So it may very well be beginning of emergence of an anthropogenic climate change signal. We're not sure yet. This is something we're continuing to watch. Again, looking at tropical storm occurrence, the numbers of tropical storms and how that's changed globally since 1980, this big red patch in observations of the Atlantic, that's indicating where tropical storm frequency has increased since 1980. And the bottom right panel is from a climate model simulating what the climate model thinks should have happened since 1980. So both of these things are showing an increase since 1980. Is that an anthropogenic climate change signal? It may be, but we don't think that it's a greenhouse gas warming signal. So let's take a look at the study that this is from. So the red curve here is the time series of tropical storms in the Atlantic Basin in their model, and the black curve are observations from 1980 to 2020 or so. So in the black curve, we see this rising trend in storm count, and the model does simulate a smaller but still has a rising trend from 1980 to 2020. It's kind of superimposed on an otherwise declining time series. What goes on in this model is that greenhouse warming is causing fewer storms in the Atlantic, and this temporary rise from 1980 to 2020 is actually driven by a reduction in aerosol forcing over the Atlantic Basin over that time period. So this is just an example of how you could have a human impact of increasing storms from 1980 to 2000, but not really implying that there's going to be an increase in the future necessarily in tropical storm frequency. Another way of looking at major hurricane counts in the Atlantic Basin is looking at this large multi-decadal variability signal. So the shaded curve here are the counts of major hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin. So it was up heavy in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, quiet for a couple of decades in the 70s and 80s, up high again in the latter part, in the last, from 1995 on. So it's been fluctuating, multi-decadal fluctuations, and so have some other important indices in the Atlantic Basin. So is vertical wind shear. So has a measure of the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation in the ocean. All of these things have had this multi-decadal fluctuation. We think that fluctuation may be partly due to this aerosol effect I talked about, or also natural variability may be contributing. The only thing that's really been increasing is this red curve in the bottom panel, and that's sea surface temperature. So it's been fluctuating again, multi-decadal variations with an increase. But these hurricane measures and wind shear and so forth have not been trending. They've been fluctuating on multi-decadal timescales. So what do the projections, what about model projections for the future? Okay, so this is for 2 degrees Celsius global warming, looking at across all studies we were able to include. So this is a sort of a study of studies. And the studies show increasing rainfall rates out of tropical cyclones that over on the right. So it's this band here is the range across different studies, and all of them are showing above zero. So it's about a 15% increase that models are predicting in tropical cyclone rainfall rates for 2 degrees of global warming. And it's very consistent across models. Another thing the models are predicting is an increase of intensity. It's about a 3% increase of intensity for 2 degrees Celsius global warming on average, with the models varying from about zero up to about 7%. Tropical cyclone frequency on the left, the average study is saying decrease, but there are some studies which show an increase. So there's sort of a split across studies. And the same thing for category 4 or 5s. The average study is showing an increase of about 10%, but there's a big range across studies with some models showing a decrease. So I'll just wrap up. This is just what the data show. Trend since 1900, no increase in U.S. landfalling major hurricanes or major hurricane counts, even though there has been anthropogenic sea surface temperature warming in the tropical Atlantic and Gulf of Mexico. Humans have likely contributed to increased extreme rainfall in general, and we think also to Hurricane Harvey's rains, for example, but we don't yet have a detectable signal in tropical cyclone rainfall. We do have a detectable signal in extreme rainfall in general around the globe. Sea level rise worsens coastal flood risk, and humans are very likely the main driver of sea level rise since 1971. Tropical cyclones they have been slowing down over the U.S. since 1901, but we're not sure why that's the case. If we're looking at trends since 1950, we see these large multi-decadal variations, which may be due to aerosol changes, it may be natural variability, we're not sure. But there's no evidence for a long-term trend since 1950. If we look at trends since 1980, everything's going up in the Atlantic. We just don't think that that's really indicative of the longer-term trend in the basin if you start looking in the decades prior to the 1980s. So we're not really sure exactly how to attribute these trends since 1980, how much of it's natural variability, how much of it's a reduction of aerosol forcing, how much of it could be greenhouse warming. That's still really a work in progress. The science, we're still working on that. And I mentioned these projections. Storm surge is getting worse. Tropical cyclone precipitation will worsen. Some increase of tropical cyclone intensity, about 3%. But then when we start getting down to the frequency, things get a lot more uncertain. So that's a quick snapshot of where the science is on this topic. Thank you.
Any questions?
Hi, Tom. Sean Sublett, formerly at Climate Central and the Richmond Times-Dispatcher in Richmond, Virginia. Do you have anything about accumulated cyclone energy in those trends?
Yes, well, that's this ACE, accumulated cyclone energy, similar to the power dissipation index I showed, which has no trend at the for U.S. landfalling, but there is a multi-decadal fluctuation in ACE and in power dissipation that looks a lot like that major hurricane count that I showed. So the ACE is sort of going to mirror what I showed for the major hurricanes, that is no long-term trend since 1900, but large multi-decadal fluctuations, possibly natural variability, possibly aerosol, possibly even some greenhouse contributions, and of course, rising trend since 1980, like everything else shows. But we're just saying that the rising trend since 1980, we don't want to overinterpret that as strictly just global warming.
Anyone else? All righty. Thanks a lot, Tom. We appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
All righty. Next up, I'm going to bring up another friend and college roommate, Michael Cook, who will be speaking on the Solar Cycle 25 and space weather impacts in a modern society.
Can I reset this, or is that just going green on its own? Good afternoon, everyone. Like TJ said, I was his roommate at all 4 years at Millersville University, where we got our meteorology degree together. But I'm Mike Cook, and I'm a space weather lead at the MITRE Corporation. So I started, you know, with terrestrial weather kind of towards the end of my undergrad. I took the Intro to Space Weather elective course that Dr. Clark was teaching at the time in Millersville, and I fell in love with it. You know, I grew up watching you, Jim, Mike, you know, others on the Weather Channel. My mom, who's here in the front row, she can tell you what the local on the eights sounded like, right? You know, parents usually were sick of watching, you know, having their kids have cartoons on the TV. It was local on the eights, you know. I just thought that every 10 minutes that came on, I was hoping that the snow totals were going up. That's what I did. I'm proud of myself for chasing that, you know, and getting my meteorology degree. But space weather seemed to be something that just maybe, you know, later in my undergrad career that I was fascinated with. So I'm going to be talking a little bit of Solar Cycle 25, which some of you, you know, may be familiar with, kind of as we're heading towards solar maximum, and especially with the recent Mother's Day storm, right, the aurora. So, you know, what are these impacts that maybe broadcast meteorologists can communicate to our public? So I'm going to teach you everything that I've learned in maybe 10 years of space weather. You're going to learn that in 90 seconds. then we're going to, you know, kind of talk about where we're currently at in Solar Cycle 25 and looking ahead. Then I'm going to touch on two events, specifically right before New Year's, December 14th, and this recent Mother's Day weekend event, really just focusing on the different stakeholders, right? Because I think the way that we view space weather, the general public may not even know that that causes the aurora, but I think most of us in the room know that that's probably the most popular or one of the few space weather impacts that you can actually see, right? We can see when it's raining outside, snowing, bad winds, things like that. And then I'll real quickly touch on the space weather certification that we have at Millersville University. So space weather 101, the solar cycle, right? It's about an 11-year cycle. You have solar maximum, which is the peak of solar activity, and then you also have what's known as solar minimum. As of right now, we are heading towards solar maximum, or we may be in it. You actually don't know that you're in solar maximum until a few months go by and you kind of look back at the data to see where the peaks were. But during solar max, we have many features called sunspots. You know, during solar maximum, you see more sunspots. During solar minimum, you see very few, and you can even go, you know, 10, 20, 40, even up to sometimes hundreds of days without having any sunspots on the solar disk during solar minimum. These produce solar flares. During solar maximum, when you have more sunspots, you have more solar flares. I think you kind of get the point. You know, solar min, less sunspots, less flares. But why we also care about these are because they can produce what are known as coronal mass ejections, and they also can produce solar energetic particle events, which we'll get into during the impacts. But these CMEs are large eruptions of plasma, And it's very important to, you know, sometimes when you read some articles, you see some people sometimes interchange solar flare and CME. That's not the case. They're two different phenomena. And sometimes solar flares produce CMEs, and sometimes they don't. Not every solar flare is accompanied by coronal mass ejection. And I think the ones that usually have the greatest impact or put on the biggest auroral displays, those faster ones usually arrive in 1 to 2 days. Some of the slower ones, about 3 to 5. And then during solar minimum, really our main source of space weather, the sun doesn't just turn off, we have coronal holes. And that's really the main source of geomagnetic storming. But the impacts and why we care, radio blackouts, radiation storms, and geomagnetic storms, which we'll get into. So currently, this is where we're at in solar cycle 25. What you're seeing on the top plot is the sunspot number, and the bottom plot, the radio flux. These are two values in which we track solar activity to, you know, kind of see how we're progressing throughout the solar cycle. And those individual black dots there, those are the monthly values for sunspot number and the F10 radio flux. The red curve was the original solar cycle 25 forecast, which we, as of now, have, you know, been outpacing. I think that's visible there. But as the solar cycle prediction panel, which is composed of some of our local science, international scientists, they updated their prediction. And we have Sean Dahl in the audience from the Space Weather Prediction Center. And they have kind of issued this experimental product where they've updated their solar cycle 25 forecast, which you can see there kind of in the magenta line. The kind of the shaded red area was the range of their original forecast. And that seems to be trending a lot better as of right now. So kind of, you know, solar cycle 25 and looking ahead, you know, a lot of the questions are we at solar max? You know, what happens after solar max? And it's very important to note that throughout the solar cycle, you can have impactful space weather events. So we really get caught up in the solar max, solar min. And actually, historically, we've had some of our most impactful space weather events after solar maximum. So it's important to realize, you know, the sun doesn't just go to sleep and we can forget about space weather. The 2003 Halloween event, which this past storm, the Mother's Day event, there were a lot of comparisons to it, you know, in terms of how strong it was. There were a lot of space weather values where they were very similar in terms of the strength. And then September 2017, does anyone know, I think a lot of this room will know what hurricane was going on during September 2017, right? And a lot of flooding events. Well, space weather was causing headaches for emergency managers during that event, which I will briefly touch on. But overall, it's important to note when these events have happened in their solar cycle, right? In solar cycle 23, the 2003 event was well after solar max, and so was the September 2017 event. That does not mean that there will always be large events after the peak of the solar cycle, but it's a reminder to, you know, it's not just about solar max and solar minimum. So this December 14th event here, SWPC put out a statement saying that this is likely one of the largest solar radio events ever recorded. Radiocom interference with aircraft were reported by some of these National Weather Service Center Weather Service units. And you can see some of the statements from these units here saying that we had some of our VHF frequencies impacted. And why that's to note is that typically these solar flares, they cause radio blackouts in the high frequency ranges, which is usually about 3 to 30 megahertz. But when they're associated with another type of space weather phenomenon known as solar radio bursts, which I don't have time to fully get into today, but these can cause impacts into much higher frequencies. And at those higher frequencies, we rely on luxuries like GPS, aviation folks are using other things like ADS-B, SATCOM. So these events can cause, you know, other impacts than just the aurora. So kind of talking about that Mother's Day weekend storm here, I have a kind of a summary slide of basically all the levels that we reached. And these levels are talking about the NOAA space weather scales. So we have scales that are from an R1 to an R5 to tell you how strong the radio blackout was from the flare, an S1 to an S5 in terms of radiation storms to let you know how severe it is, and then geomagnetic storms from a G1 to a G5. During this week leading up to the storm, we had 10 R2 level events, 12 R3 level events. Remember, this scale only goes to R5. We had an S1 and S2 radiation storm, which is relevant for aviation operations, our astronauts on the ISS. And then in terms of geomagnetic storming, what produces the aurora can also cause other impacts to GPS, the power grid. This was our first G5 event in about 20 plus years. So this was a very notable and I would say historic space weather event that we lived through. So who, you know, all right, I just told you a lot about space weather, and it's like, you know, all right, who cares? Like, please, like, tell me why this is relevant, and, you know, how can I help educate the public? You know, in one of the senses is GPS, and the Midwest farmers, they had a headache from this storm. You know, you had John Deere that sent out text messages to their customers while this storm was ongoing, saying that some of their tractor systems may be extremely compromised. I was sitting at home really trying to not laugh at this statement in the upper right, but this gentleman from South Dakota said that it showed the tractor going in circles and auto steer didn't work. And I'm just imagining, you know, a gentleman looking out his window, seeing his tractor doing donuts in the field. So, you know, many different states throughout Nebraska, Minnesota, South Dakota, a lot of farmers that were relying on this precision farming were having issues. You can even see this photo in the bottom right-hand corner there. Those definitely don't look like two straight of lines in kind of how the GPS was having some issues. So what about power grid impacts, right? You know, I think some of you maybe have heard of the Carrington event, and we're very concerned about maybe the power grid failing. Well, the Space Weather Prediction Center has done a great job kind of coordinating and educating the different stakeholders, right? And they even held a media day, I believe it was a day or two in advance of this storm, and they coordinated with the power grid operators ahead of this storm. And even with that, you know, they're still were some irregularities, as I believe what you guys call them, Sean. I don't have any more details on that. It doesn't look like that there was any, you know, major failures or things like that. But if we're looking here kind of at this this model that is on the SWPSI website with NOAA and the USGS, this is kind of what the model looks like, you know, under normal conditions or background conditions. I won't go into kind of the details of this and the science behind the models, but I think you can see a pretty clear difference of background conditions here and then what this model looked like during the storm, right? Clearly something is not at background levels anymore, right? And NERC, our North American Electric Reliability Company, they're planning to publish a report on this event, and some of our international friends of, you know, New Zealand even issued a grid emergency notice and implemented some of their mitigation plans. So we've talked about GPS, power grid, and then now the aviation community. And I thought this was a really nice detailed, you're basically seeing a log from an ops floor from Collins Aerospace, who operates basically San Fran radio, which is the radio over the Pacific, and the New York radio over the Atlantic. You know, they help these pilots communicate. And just here highlighted throughout May 11th, which is when we really had that large storm. You were having a large geomagnetic storm go on at the same time as many of these M and X class solar flares. And these are their operators taking notes, saying there's an HF comms blackout in the North Pacific and Central West Pacific regions. Operators affected had to resort to utilizing SATCOM to handle many of the flights in the region during this time. Generally, they rely on their HF radio. That clearly was not working. Later at 16Z, HF comms off the west coast of continental U.S. had been severely degraded to near blackout conditions. And then shortly after, severe disruption of HF comms in the central west Pacific region reported by the operator on duty. Their ATC messages that were timing out, air traffic control messages, they were up by about 83% compared to the prior week with this week of activity or these 2 days. So that's kind of summarizes, you know, the level of impacts and the different stakeholders that are impacted by this. When these flights go over the ocean and at polar, these polar flights above 78 degrees north, they rely on HF radio. You know, other flights over the U.S., you know, they have SATCOM as a backup, but in certain areas, HF is their only comm method. Another stakeholder is low Earth orbit. We just keep sending up constellations into low Earth orbit, endless satellites, and I think you guys have probably heard about the SpaceX incident about 2 years ago where they lost, I think it was 38 or 39 of their Starlink satellites due to a geomagnetic storm, right? So this commercial satellite industry and commercial space, which continues to grow, they should be aware of space weather. They need to be aware of space weather, or their missions that were designed for, say, 5 to 7 years may only last 3 to 4 years, depending on satellite drag. And what you're looking here at the left plot, that is the altitude change in kilometers per week of the Hubble Space Telescope. And you can see how it correlates with solar activity, because on the bottom, you see the solar activity peak there in about 2000, 2002. That was solar cycle 23. You can see the deviations, right, of the Hubble Space Telescope there. Then as solar activity goes down, right, towards solar minimum, because solar drag or satellite drag is not as impactful during solar minimum, you don't see as many variations, right? And then let's look around 2015, 2013, the peak of solar cycle 24. Solar cycle 24 is really weak. You only see minor deviations. But so far in solar cycle 25, you know, it's a little bit stronger of a cycle. You're seeing more deviations in the Hubble Space Telescope altitude decay. And with that, I'd just like to wrap this up by saying that we've created this space weather certificate program at Millersville University. And one of the main targets is really the broadcast community. You guys are on the forefront of educating the public, and I think space weather could be a part of that. I think it should be. So we have myself, Dr. Tamitha Scove, who you guys may know as Space Weather Woman on Twitter, YouTube, and other social media channels. And we're very lucky to have Dr. Jeannie Meehan, who is now at the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. You're going to have them for 3 of the 5 courses. You'll have Dr. Yalda for one of them, and unfortunately, you have to take class with me. It's only one, so don't let that deter you away from the program, and it's fully online. It's a great time, and the folks that have taken this program, it's really awesome to see what they're doing and where they're at with their career. I'm slightly over, so with that, you know, maybe I could take a question or two, but I'm here for, you know, the rest of the week, and I'd really like to have, you know, follow-up conversations with you guys. I'm very passionate about space weather, so, you know, please feel free to reach out.
We can take one question. Anybody has one?
This may sound stupid, but why 25? When did we start counting solar cycles, and when was zero, and how we got to 25?
Well, Sean, I hate to call you out on your age here, but when did we when exactly was the first solar cycle that we technically started tracking? So, Paul, you were asking, does the sunspot count start at when it gets to, reaches to zero? Is that solar minimum? Yeah, I believe when you look back at the data, Sean can clarify me on this, but it's when your sunspot count, I'm not quite sure that it reaches zero for, however, you will have zero for some consecutive months, because you can have stretches of 100 plus days of zero sunspots at all. And then when you start to see that sunspot number increasing again is when they look back and make the determination of when they're going to say solar minimum is. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mike.
All right, our next presenter is Alex Camilla. He is going to be talking about putting down roots, gardening localizes the weather story. You ready, Alex?
Yeah, thanks, Vanessa. Thanks so much, everybody, for having me. I am so excited to talk to all of you because you all get it, right? I think most of us are born with this passion for weather, and it just so happens that I was lucky enough to be born with two passions equally. It was weather and it's gardening. And just to backtrack a little bit, I'm a meteorologist at News 12 on Long Island, but I found a way for many years juggled with these equal passions and meshed them together into one. So first, a little bit of background. These aren't the awkward photos, by the way, of me as a kid. If you want to see those, you can find me later for that. But because they're bad. So basically what I used to do was garden for my parents from a really, really young age. 8 years old, I gardened the whole entire thing, which isn't much because we live on Staten Island. Now I live on Long Island. But so it wasn't a huge yard, but I was very proud about that flower. To the top right, that is a pond tree, and that was my high school graduation gift. So just to preface that this is New York, so this is already kind of weird, right? The bottom right is my palm tree today. Actually, last summer. It's even bigger this year. So the garden has always been a weather lab for me. It's a place of experimentation, of fun. That was how I grew up. I figured maybe I'd go to college. You know, I've lived in Florida, South Carolina, and that passion still stayed, and those plants never moved out of my parents' house. So I'm sorry, Mom and Dad. those do go in the kitchen every single winter. But it tells a story, right? This is my backyard, so if you feel bad for my parents, listen to, I got a lot more. So I'm growing banana plants. I'm growing citrus. You know, it's important to know your audience. We've got a ton of Italians on Long Island. They want their citrus. They want their figs, so I'm growing both of them with them. And that palm tree was actually something I bought off eBay in my freshman year of high school as a little tiny seedling. And it survives the winter in New York. I cover it up some years, but I do it a whole lot less every single year now. So this is really telling a very compelling story. My neighbors don't think so, though, because they see me with a flashlight and a garden hose at 2:30 in the morning because I'm a morning meteorologist. So that's when the plants get watered. Thank you very much. I'm glad you're all amused. I feel like I'm going to get the cops called on me one day. So if you see my mugshot, please, you know, it was all very harmless. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Garden Guide now. So this is a segment that I created. I'm going to tell you the backstory behind this, too, because this is not a unique concept to bring gardening to the news. But it's a minute-long segment. That's it. Like I said, I'm a morning meteorologist. You guys get it. We don't have a ton of time in our schedule. And this airs every Wednesday and Sunday morning. Now, the goal here is to make gardening more fun for people and to generate that hyper-local content, especially on sunny days, because now I'm establishing a meaningful connection with our audience, and that could be a really, really wonderful thing. Actually, I went to go get some flowers for my mom for Mother's Day, and I was at the garden center for 4 hours. So, yeah. And I loved every second of it. I was there with a friend, and they were like, Alex, that's a lot, but I had the most fun time. It was great. And so not only am I establishing this meaningful connection with our audience, but also with arborists, and they're doing incredible things that I didn't even realize. So, for example, I didn't know that basically they can do an MRI of a tree and find out where the rot is inside of it. So they can do an analysis and tell you if your tree is going to fall and how many miles per hour of wind they estimate it's going to take for that tree to fall. And I'm sure you've all gotten storm damage photos, and what's the first one you see? It's usually trees going down. And trees are not the problem here, right? It's the right tree for the right place. So it's very interesting, you know, that that is something that arborists can actually do. So making those connections with actual professionals is fantastic. So like I said, I'm in New York now. That's where I was born. That's where I grew up. But I've spent some time here in the Palmetto State as well. So before Garden Guide, there is a very, very special place, WLTX, with an incredible meteorologist who's here with us, Jim Gandy. He's an AMS fellow. You all know him. He is a legend. Certainly no introduction needed for Jim, but I'm going to give some highlights on this incredible project. This is him at the White House, by the way, that he was invited to. And around that time, he also started an incredible garden at WLTX in South Carolina, and this is Gandhi's garden. So the difference here, I do Garden Guide in New York in my backyard, but I worked at WLTX for a couple of years prior to this, and the garden there is right outside of a newsroom. It's really important that you remember this is outside of a newsroom, and I'm going to tell you why in a second. So what Jim did was educate people about where their food was coming from during a time where California was undergoing a huge drought. I know they're doing a lot better now, but two-thirds of the food in our country comes from California, so you know that things are going to wax and wane and change a whole lot. You know, water is worth gold there. So I worked at WLTX in 2019, which is when Jim retired as chief meteorologist. I actually worked there because there was a garden. I thought that was really special. And I had already had a garden segment at my first market in Florida and had some really great connections with IFAS because obviously Florida, next to tourism, agriculture is huge there. But what happened in that year after 2019? The pandemic. Yeah. So the pandemic hit, but the garden actually continued to really take off. So remember when I said it was outside the building, right? That's important because during quarantine, that was the only place I was allowed. That was the closest I was allowed to the building. And so I just, you know, filled this up with tropical plants. And yeah, you know, I had to add my little spin and flavor to it. but what was really unique about the pandemic was that audience connection. That was when I started to connect the dots that this was something really valuable to our audience as more than just show me your garden photos. So, you know, during the pandemic, I created a Facebook group for our audience and 1,000 people instantly joined practically. I mean, it was totally organic. Always pun intended with me, by the way. so, yeah, and it was really, really special because it became self-sustained. It was actually something that I didn't have to babysit. I was also a morning meteorologist at WLTX, so very busy, but they took care of it themselves. One of the members, Dorinda, I always call the mayor of the Facebook group because she posts every day. So back up to cold and snowy New York. Here's where I work now. News 12 is very unique because we are a 24-hour local news network within the New York City market. So that's market number one, but we are split up into 5 different regions because we have that hyper-local focus. So I'm based out of the Long Island region. There's New Jersey, Connecticut, Hudson Valley. You get the idea, right? Garden Guide airs in all 5 of those regions, but I add my little extra flavor of viewer photos to the region I'm responsible for, which is Long Island. And since we own the channel, we have a ton of flexibility. Right now, Garden Guide lives within the newscast, but kind of the goal here is to produce a half-hour long segment because we have half-hour long segments of local programming. And so that's the dream. It takes a lot of resources to do that, but there's definitely a demand for
it. Here's what it looks like. This is the montage. My passion for weather and plants, yeah. You know, it comes in handy.
Tell us a little bit about the history of these azalea flowers in particular.
And as pretty as these flowers look, they're just as tasty.
Are you noticing?
It tastes like arugula.
As we've talked about before, these plants are sturdy, and then Mother Nature does the rest, like blueberries. What's really cool about blueberries is that they're going to come back year after year. But today, we're going to talk about the containers themselves and the soil that they're growing in.
This tree species has remained exactly the same for the last 200 million years, making it a true living fossil. Only female trees produce fruit, and they make a mess, and they smell like vomit. You plant a tree now.
They do.
And you don't live to see it in its prime. So you're really doing that for the next generation.
Yeah. Taking care of mature trees is a very rewarding career.
Crocus are so low to the ground that even if temperatures drop into the 20s, they're going to be fine.
Well, soaring grocery prices are hitting us all, but growing plants from seeds are an easy way to cut the cost. Watermelon typically don't do well in containers. These are such tiny plants, and look at the roots are already crawling out. Can you believe that?
Not only do I have watermelon, but I don't have a patio anymore, guys. I mean, look at all of these watermelon vines.
Some people ask me, like when I do those garden segments, if that's my backyard. And yeah, unfortunately, I don't even know if I'd consider it a backyard anymore because the plants have officially taken over.
It's a tropical forest.
Yeah, I'm like hopping through.
I recently invited Erin to my backyard, and she was disappointed that it wasn't as crowded yet. I told her to come back in October. So, the reality is, of course, we only have so much time to do this segment, right? So I'm going to talk about a couple of different topics and why I did it. So starting with this really special tree, Ginkgo biloba. This is actually a picture I took in South Carolina when I was down here. It's a tree that you probably have in your neighborhood. It is one of the most versatile trees in the world and one of the most common. But this is actually a rare example of a tree that humans saved. Usually we're hearing how we destroy the planet, but ginkgos actually pretty much exist worldwide because of humans now. In China, they saw the value of this tree, and now it is everywhere. It's older than the dinosaurs. This is a living fossil. It's been unchanged for hundreds of millions of years. And I guess that's why it does so well in our cities. It has really withstood everything. But there are only a small population of them in the wild until humans, thousands of years ago, saw their value. And the reality is, this was in our parking lot and was something to talk about for a half hour. So during my dinner break, that's what we did. So just to give you an idea, prior to working at News 12, I was MMJing all of my garden segments all of the time. WLTX, my first market. It was camera. It was editing. All of that fun. Now I have a photographer who kind of like makes it look a little prettier, but I still edit the segment. I still write the segment. So it is time consuming, but obviously I have a lot of fun. So the watermelon was about knowing your audience. You know, I live in New York now, and we don't have a lot of land. So this was a fun plant that maybe people didn't realize could grow as a potted patio plant. So it's really important to know your audience and give them something that they can actually use. Obviously, I grow normal plants too, but, you know, the watermelon was a little bit more fun. And this was interesting because obviously I love my tropical plants, but there are actual companies now that are making money growing palm trees in New York. That is super unusual, to say the least. But what they do is they wrap up these cold-tolerant palm tree species. Actually, this is a Trachycarpus, which is growing in the parking lot right at this hotel. So it's growing in Myrtle Beach, and it's growing in New York. And then I mentioned, I do a little local flavor for Long Island. So what I do is I compile garden photos. I get anywhere from a dozen to maybe 100 every single week, unsolicited garden photos. And I just share their neighborhoods, why they're not doing well. I get a lot of really, honestly, like humbling stories. You know, some people have plants that are, you know, generational, and they're dying and they need help. So, you know, this is like another way on a sunny day that I'm there for the audience. This is called a skunk cabbage, by the way. So if you're worried about AI taking your job, no worries at all about this, because this is a thermogenic plant. So it actually creates its own weather. So that is one I'm watching. That could take my job. Basically what it does is it actually releases some heat when it sprouts in the spring. So that way it can melt the snow around. It can be one of the first plants to bloom. And the blooms attract flies, so it smells terrible. So don't plant it. So in addition to talking about, you know, whether I'm talking about plants in my school talks, and even at a young age, kids are really, really getting it. They're sharing photos and drawings of weather and fruits, and they're understanding that connection. And I spoke to the digital team at News 12 before I went to this conference, and they shared some pretty cool, interesting information with me. And that is, when I looked at the top garden guide articles on the website, you notice there's winter, winter, summer, hardy, cold. What do all of these key words have in mind? They're all weather related. So weather still wins. And I'm reaching the millennials too on Instagram mostly. Facebook is great. That third one is all right some days. I don't know how to pronounce it anymore. It's either Twitter or X, but feel free to follow me there. By a show of hands, who's a gardener, by the way? Oh my gosh, wow. So that's actually like more than half of you. So please feel free to follow me along there, and I'll follow you all back too, because I would love to see your plant photos. And if we have any time, I'll take any questions.
We'll take one question.
Thank you, Dave.
We love you, Dave.
What is eating my edamame plant?
Ooh.
We live in Annapolis, and and we planted edamames for the first time. They were starting to grow up, looked really nice. Boom, the leaves are gone. You know, so something is, what's eating them?
So my guess is, because of how wet it's been, it's probably slugs. They usually come out at night, and so if you come out at night with a flashlight.
Salt,
yep,
right?
Well, so it's interesting. I was actually curious because I have a lot of slug problems too. So we're very similar climate-wise. And what I had found is actually an organic snail bait that you can use and sprinkle it around your plants at night. And the snails will eat it. And, I don't know, die. So they don't come back. So you can try that.
Somebody told us cinnamon. You know, if you sprinkle cinnamon, you know, we have a bunch of strawberries, and we sprinkle cinnamon on it, and the bugs kind of, the little pill bugs, they go away.
So. Well, cinnamon, too, is also a natural antifungal. So with strawberries, a lot of times you get a fungal issue when they're getting ready to ripen. So cinnamon is great to prevent that. And your copper fungicide is going to be great in the south, too, because now everything is going to start getting powdery mildew on it. So as Jim knows, because I think you were just saying that you were dealing with that at the garden at WLTX, right?
That's really cool. So, okay, we have a weeping cherry.
Why is it crying? Thank you guys so much.
All right, and our last one of the symposium is going to be Mike Mogill, and he's going to be talking about the disappearance of weather and climate, both in quality and quantity in K-12 textbooks. And he's remote, so we're going to get him up here real soon, hopefully.
Hey, Mike, can you hear us? Are you with us? No? Okay. You should call it. There's three. Well, it looks like we're just going to call it, sadly. I know we have another session, but yeah, I don't think Mike is going to be with us, sadly. So with that, is he here? He's unable to Okay, should I run out and get Tracy, maybe?
Yeah.
You want me to run out?
I can run out.
Are you sure? Okay. Oh, of course.
Yep. While we're waiting, I thought I'd get the mic before Dave Jones. So just a follow-up question about Slack from the – I'm Mike Farrell from the National Weather Service. It's not my job to do Slack, but this problem that was brought up the last couple of days is not a new problem. It's been going on since we went to Slack. We've had a lot of feedback over the last year. So I didn't want to speak up this morning because it wasn't current, so I talked to the office director who's running this. I got some good news for you folks. Not only do we hear you, we've been working on this for months. There's actually a fix that's already been developed with working with Slack. It's going to be started this month to be tested internally. If everything works, it's going to get rolled out. So we heard what your concerns were. Stand by. The fix is coming. It's actually going to be called syndicated channels. Be able to combine the various channels into one place, just like you all were used to. So anyway, I just want to be good news. There we go.
It says I'm unmuted. I hope I am.
Oh. Hey, thank Mike. You all. Glad to have you.
Okay, I'll try to get started here and try to finish up before 4:30. No, seriously, I have a lot of stuff, but I'm going to plow through it pretty quickly. My name is Mike Mogul. I'm a certified consulting meteorologist, certified broadcast meteorologist. I've done a little bit of what you guys and gals have done. But I basically have wound up in Collier County, Florida, where I've been very heavily involved in science in the schools and the textbook issues. And I'm going to give you the conclusions of my talk first so that if anybody has to leave, they'll understand. Textbooks in public schools suck. textbooks in public schools can't be redeemed. The process is too convoluted. I'm going to explain that to you so you all know what's happening. And it's going to, as several of the speakers have alluded to, if the broadcasters don't do it, it isn't going to get done. Schools are very heavily involved in a framework that everyone has to do the same thing at the same time with the same materials. And bringing in outside stuff like what Dave and his partner are proposing and other things is very, very tough unless the school system buys into it. And that is very tough in the environment with state-approved curriculum, state-approved textbooks, and so forth. So I'm going to take you through this so you understand what's involved and why you need to be more broadcast station scientists than fighting the school system internally. I have basically decided the textbook process is not worth it. So let me take you through my presentation real quickly. Here's my information. I'll put it up on the screen at the end if anyone wants to reach me. And some disclaimers very quickly. I'm not a certified teacher, but my wife has taught for 25 years and has constantly served as my mentor. I suspect most of your women know that. I spent most of my 55 years in meteorology doing education, training, writing, et cetera. I even wound up working for Dave for a while. And I spent a lot of time reviewing Collier County textbooks, not just science, but math, history, English, in order to see what's going on in those textbooks. And I can tell you that they're bad on many, many levels. Now I get to educate attorneys, judges, and juries as a certified consulting meteorologist. My audience is smaller than yours, but I get to have six people in a jury box that are paying very close attention to my every word. So most of my comments are going to center on Florida textbooks, but I have examined books and online materials in other states. And I hope some of you may be able to fill in missing holes, because even though I'm not going to spend time reviewing textbooks in the future, I am going to fight the textbook issue. And please recognize the differences between education, which is what the school systems push, that's open your mouth and swallow, versus real learning, like the kind that Alex was just talking about. And by the way, Alex, I love seeing the plumeria growing on Long Island. My wife's cousins in Houston, Texas, have to dig theirs up every winter and bring them into the garage. We have a plumeria here in Florida. It's in a pot, only because our condo association won't let us plant it. But that's another issue.
I'll fight them with you.
Okay, good deal. So before I go through the local process, understand that there's a state-level review to ensure that any standards agreed to in the state are met. And there's an incredible list of standards by all the subjects. It's hundreds of pages. Then there follows that when the textbooks come in, they review them at the state, and then the textbook publishers come to visit the school system and present their books to the teachers and outside interests. Then there's meetings to instruct those that are going to be reviewing the textbooks. And then there's schedule time set aside for reviewers at the local level to sit and review, discuss with other people, and vote on their preferred books. You can see that this makes government bureaucracy pale by comparison. So we have time for review, very extensive, availability of materials. If you want hard copy books, you have to go into the school. You can't take them home. Meetings, when they review textbooks and present materials, they often run into the family dinner hour. The documentation process is long and laborious. and evaluation is stacked in favor of the school system. There are up to 7 teachers, 7 administrators, and 7 parents. Do the math. The school system is ahead 2-1. So this is what a review looks like for the science textbooks. And you can see that there's 20 textbook series. These are not individual books. These are series. So some of the books may span K-5. Some of them may span 6-8. But they get reviewed. And imagine the workload that goes into this review process. And there's no way to totally review everything in the textbooks. It's physically, mentally, and otherwise impossible. So here are some of the key points here. In reviewing the textbooks, I have now discovered that K-12 textbooks continue to remove weather basics, advanced information, technology, safety, etc., and just replace it with blanket statements about carbon dioxide forced climate change. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't do climate change in the school system. What I am saying is, imagine for a moment that you're a brain surgeon and you're talking to a patient who's going to undergo surgery tomorrow. And the patient asks you if you've ever had a course in basic anatomy and physiology, and you reply, no. I guarantee your patient will be out of your office faster than you can say Dave Jones. Many textbooks contain material or are themselves not grade level appropriate. So you wind up with questions that may ask students, what's going to happen if the temperature of the earth warms by 2 degrees? What do you think will happen to the climate? What do you think will happen to weather? Remember, they've had no decent weather background up to this point. That's a question in a fifth grade science textbook. So stair-stepping of knowledge, basic understanding is missing. The textbooks urge listening and discussion, only to then push advocacy. You need to get out there and save the earth. You need to get out there and save the whales, whatever. And they have no clue what they're pushing. They advocate for critical thinking, lots of solutions. They come up with a single causation factor and a single solution. And you and I know, and all of you, I think, know this, that science is supposed to involve questioning. Just because we know something today doesn't mean we're not going to learn something tomorrow that refutes what we know today. And I can give you plenty of examples of that. We could talk COVID if we want. We could talk the food triangle. We can talk lots of different things. And I don't think weather and climate is any different. So here's an example of an environmental book where they talk about major fields of study that contribute to environmental science. Look at the second group, earth science, and you'll notice that meteorologists and oceanographers are not mentioned. Many pictures in the books are not referenced. They're not sourced. They're just there and they're out of context. I'm going to give you one example. I wish I had the image. I'm afraid I don't. It's a young girl, maybe 8 or 9, blonde hair, probably blue eyes, in a Western-style swimsuit. She's on a beach. There's no indication of cover-up or a hat or anything like that for sun safety. And plastered across the screen, or the image, I should say, it says 108 degrees Fahrenheit. Anybody want to tell me where a beach exists with 108 degree Fahrenheit air temperature? No takers? Saudi Arabia. And that girl is not going to be on the beach in that bathing suit. And that's cultural and totally out of context and scientifically incorrect. There's often incorrect images for the points being made. And many of the textbooks contain outdated or incorrect information. And remember that once the books are written and published and bought by the school system, they're going to be at that school system for at least 5 more years. So the information could be a decade or more older than when the books are being used. The data says we're going to do critical thinking and cross-disciplinary approaches. And we saw a bunch of that with emergency management and the IWT meetings. So here's a set of data about tropical rainforests and how many acres are lost. And the questions have nothing to do with what's going on in the rainforest. They are simply mathematical problems using a data table. So they missed the boat on this one of accomplishing anything about cross-curricula linkages. This is what the form looks like when you have to evaluate it. Each item has to be on a separate line. So I'm going to skip through that and say, here's two objections that I presented in that format out of hundreds. And in this case, the first one talks about upward motion along a cold front. The textbook is written for Florida, and they never mention sea breeze thunderstorms. The word terrifying is used for lightning. And why that's being used instead of simply loud or something else says that there's a bias and error in what's going on here, because sometimes lightning and thunder are quite distant and they're low rumbles and they're probably not terrifying. They might not even be loud. And this is what happens after I presented 100 errors, omissions, and biases at a school board meeting. The school system had their 20 minutes of presentation, or I'm sorry, 10 minutes of presentation to refute what I presented. And they basically said, well, these textbooks were reviewed at the state, and therefore they are approved. Your comments are meaningless. Jeez. So I raised the issue with the school board, then why do we need these people to refute my comments? We can get them out of the school system. So the bottom line is that reviewing textbooks critically for time and other factors and going through the process and involving parents and other people is basically impossible. And so you get the responsibility, folks, just like I do, just like private sector people, parents, et cetera. We have to do the education, I'm sorry, the learning, instill the learning in the kids. And when I say get involved in the textbook review, I mean make sure at least the textbook review is solid. Push the state to get the books reviewed properly at the state level. Continue what you're doing on air and through other means. Teacher workshops, museum visits, etc. And you need to do more. I attend integrated warning team workshops here in South Florida, both for Melbourne and Miami. Not Melbourne, I'm sorry, Tampa and Miami. And I'm going to do Melbourne next year. And they've let me make a couple of presentations as well. And I did talk about the CCM program this year at Miami and then did a separate presentation in Tampa. You can participate in STEAM or STEM programs where they ask for people from the community to participate in Saturday events at schools. That's a great way to reach other parents and so forth. And since science and weather, I mean, environment and weather are natural buddies, as Alex showed us a few moments ago, let's get some weather observing sites at nature preserves and state parks and other places where they seem to be missing. Even the National Park Service doesn't have weather data at all of their parks. And obviously, presentations at these places are great as well. And as I said, more, you can't do enough. When I testify at trials, I have six people and a extra in a jury box, and I have to explain every single thing to them, words, pictures, you name it. They do not come in armed with weather information, and I want them to make an intelligent conclusion. So I leave you with this scene from an old Star Trek show. This is where Scotty is trying to get McCoy to help him in an engineering situation. And Scotty gets a response from McCoy that's, damn it, Scotty, I'm a doctor, not an engineer. Well, damn it, world. I want you folks to be a learning facilitator, not just a meteorologist. So my final pitch is more education through WeatherWise magazine. I know some of you have contributed. Troy Kimmel was a co-author on this article of Weather and Climate of Texas. I still have 20 states that I'm working on. Now that we're through COVID, I'm going to work on completing them. If anybody wants to help out, I'm glad to take volunteers. You will get a stipend for contributing. You may be able to buy a dinner at the local restaurant, but not much more than that. So I leave that to everyone else. Thanks for sneaking me in with the communications issues. I'm glad we could do it. And next year I'll try to attend the meeting instead of being remote. But right now I'm just going through training echo pattern number 14 for the last 3 days. And we are not as bad as Miami here in Naples. We've only had 8 inches of rain, but we did have flooding in our downtown area yesterday. But Miami had 15 to 20 inches of rain. And as they like to say on TV, you don't need a tropical storm to make rainfall problems.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Yeah.
One quick question.
Hey, Michael, it's Wes at CBS in Raleigh. My wife's on the PTA in Central North Carolina, so we understand frustrations of the school board. But I'm wondering, when they refuted your data, did they say who or what their position or role was to say, nope, you're wrong, sorry?
Well, they didn't say I was wrong per se. They just said they weren't going to accept my comments because the books were approved. And the problem is that if you say, even if they were to say, well, I agree on page 14 that the statement is incorrect, we will tell the publisher. I have no way of knowing if they tell the publisher, no way of knowing if the publisher does anything about it. And they're spending millions and millions of dollars just in Collier County on textbooks. Imagine that multiplied across the United States. And whether they're paperback or hardback or whether they're online, they're still paying millions upon millions of dollars for these textbooks that are not educating our kids and not helping kids learn and develop curiosity. So I wish your wife the best. Let her be a voice. Every voice helps.
And we'll take one question from you, Joe.
All right. I'm going to get us out of here quick. I just want to say hi to Mike. He actually was a big reason that I'm here in the broadcast world today. I went to one of his weather camps in high school with Howard University. So he's been in the education field for probably 12 plus years. So I want to say thank you for what you're doing and keep up the good work.
12 years, huh? I only wish.
Yeah.
The sum of the digits in my age is 16 next month. You can all figure it out.
Thank you so much again, Mike.
We are. Take care, everyone.
Bye. All right, everyone. You will have a very short coffee break. Be back here at 3:45 for our big NWS panel.